What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Sam Glazer, Jewish music star and author of the new book, The Joy of Judaism. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Shinshinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy, and our Maven on Israel, Imbal Shtivi. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Today we are commemorating the first anniversary on the American calendar of the horrific shooting at the Pittsburgh Tree of Life Synagogue a year ago. As you probably remember, that terrorist act, a massacre perpetrated by a white supremacist who claimed to be protecting the white race from the influence of Jews who were allowing immigrants to enter the United States, included the execution of 11 innocent, mostly elderly Jews praying in shul on Shabbos morning, along with the wounding of 7 others. Many synagogues, including my own congregation Beit Simcha, have included the names of those victims on our Kaddish list this year, but the painful reminder that it has now been exactly a year since that horrific massacre still comes as something of a shock. So, what's happened since the brutal Pittsburgh attack, first of its kind in all of American history? A number of things. While many synagogues increased security after the Tree of Life white terrorist attack, it must be noted that the second fatal synagogue attack in Poway, California on Pesach convinced many more shuls to take serious action to prevent future incidents like these. In a practical sense, synagogues are spending resources on self-defense that would previously have gone to Jewish education, religious needs, social justice, and other good purposes. American congregations are starting to look more like European and other international synagogues, with layers of security, armed guards, and other preventive measures in place. In a sociological sense, studies show that more American Jews, and especially more Jewish children, are hiding the fact that they are Jewish. For those of us who are very proud of our Jewish identity and share our incredible heritage with others, this is a disturbing and somewhat shocking trend. I have a great confirmation class at my own synagogue, Congregation Beit Simcha, here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, which for some inexplicable demographic reason happens to consist of all teenage boys with no girls. Our younger students are equally divided in my school between girls and boys, but not the confirmation class. In any case, we had a discussion with them about anti-Semitism here in southern Arizona, and two of the young men, great kids, very actively Jewish, who volunteer extensively at our temple, noted that they don't really let their classmates in public school know that they are Jewish. They're concerned about anti-Semitic backlash, and they've either experienced it in the past or seen it done to those around them. This is America in 2019, here in the Southwest. It's not Nazi Germany in the 30s. It's not communist Russia in the 50s. It's not the KKK-tinged American South of the early 60s. It's not Boston in the midst of the school bus controversies of the 70s. It's not Paris today with its huge North African anti-Israel minorities. Frankly, I was shocked. The need for teens to feel that they have to hide their own Jewish identity today in the United States. Wow. These are indeed weird and disturbing and very troubling times. May the memory of the victims in Pittsburgh bring us to a better time of healing and hope, and pride in our Jewish heritage that we can express publicly. Right now, that day seems farther off than it has been in a long time. In happier news, we have at long last completed the final fall festivals of the Jewish tradition. We finished Simchat Torah last week. While the month of remarkable Jewish celebrations and observances are wonderful, they are also exhausting, not least for rabbis and cantors, of which I am both. But I have to share a final story from this extreme festival cycle, a Simchat Torah tale for this year. It's from last Monday night's celebration of the holiday of Torah. On Simchat Torah, we complete the reading of this central book of our faith and the foundation of all Western religion by chanting the last sentences of the book of Deuteronomy. We then begin reading it all over again, chanting the first verses of the book of Genesis, demonstrating our love for Torah. To emphasize this love, to make the holiday really fun, we circle the sanctuary seven times in a ceremony called Hakafot. These hakafot are always accompanied by songs about the Torah. By marching, the synagogue's Torahs around the sanctuary, and all the children present marching along, waving flags, holding toy Torahs, and so on. These perambulations, these hakafot, become more and more celebratory as they go, until by the time you reach the seventh hakafah, there is real revelry taking place. In my own congregation, Beit Simcha, we had a fabulous celebration, great joyous music, full-on dancing, singing, lots of fun. This reminds me of when I first arrived at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati as a third-year rabbinical school student. I was to become cantor in the chapel there, but for Simchat Torah, I was just a congregant. I sat through the first few hakafot, the parades with the Torah, listening to dull, plodding songs. Finally, I turned to the dean of the college, Rabbi Kanterlich, and asked him what was going on. Like me, he is mostly descended from Eastern European Jews who do Simchas Torah with singing and dancing, great enthusiasm and energy, a kind of wanton celebration. Ken explained that when he first came to the college, the Torah Hakafot for Simchat Torah were done in a slow, stately procession, accompanied by plodding organ music. He himself had turned to a professor and asked, "It's Simchas Torah. How come they're marching, not dancing?" And the professor answered, "They are German Jews. They are dancing." Anyway, that's not the story I want to tell this morning. This happened on a Monday night as the hakafot, the Torah circling, had really gotten going. We were on the sixth hakafah. I'd called up just about everybody who wanted to carry a Torah. I noticed a very active man, a congregant who hadn't come up yet, sitting quietly. I called him up by name. Slowly, he made his way up, took a Torah, and joined in the festivities, carried it around the congregation. But later, that same night, I received an email from him. "I'm sorry I didn't come up sooner," he said, "but I've been working on losing weight recently. My clothes are much looser. As I sat there on Simchat Torah, I realized I forgot to put on a belt. My trousers were so loose that when I stood up, I had to hold them up with one hand. That made it impossible to use both hands to hold the Torah, so I stayed in my seat. But then you called me up publicly. I had no choice. I came forward. I told the gabbai, the guy passing out the Torahs, that if I took the Torah, my pants would fall down. My boxers would flash the whole congregation, which would dramatically change the character of Simchat Torah." The gabbai said, "That'll make YouTube," but then he offered to give me the Torah and walk behind me, holding up my pants so they don't fall off. And that's how I completed my own hakafah on Simchat Torah. My friends, that's too good a story for me to have made it up. And so, for a final playout, for the tail end of the Jewish holiday season, now in our rearview mirrors, here's a bit of klezmer music from the great Giora Feidman, perhaps the best klezmer clarinetist ever. That was a klezmer celebration melody in honor of Simchat Torah, the celebration of Torah, which concluded our Jewish fall festival cycle early last week. Our own guest this morning, Jewish music star Sam Glazer, has written a new, very personal book that summarizes all of Judaism. It's called The Joy of Judaism. Find out why in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish a good friend, Sam Glazer, best known as a Jewish musical star, is the author of the new book, The Joy of Judaism, a really engaging and enjoyable practical guide, I guess a general introduction to Judaism. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Shalom, Sam. How are you?
I'm good. You know, after you survived all the Jewish holidays, there's a sort of holiday free zone, which is remarkable. What percentage of your book do you think is focused on the holiday experience of Judaism?
It's two of the 10 sections of the book. So there's 70 chapters, and it's divided into 10 sections. And I opted to divide the holidays, since it is quite a bit of material, into the spring and summer festivals and then the fall and winter festivals.
You know, what I like about your book, as opposed to so many introductory books on Judaism, which all are valuable, many of them are really great, is that this is a really personal book, too, isn't it?
Absolutely. I've been, as you know, on the road for almost 30 years now, doing about 50 cities a year, sometimes around the world, and I get to see Jewish communities of all types. And I'm also very happy to be playing in Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox settings. So it's very interesting to see what everybody brings to the klal, to the group, and what's working and what's not working. And thankfully, music is a common denominator that seems to unite everyone. So, you know, that's where I come in. And
now, so I think for those people that know you as a musician and the story, you often tell stories in your songs, but that's not the same thing as saying, okay, what do I really think Judaism is? That's a really comprehensive approach. What provoked you to do this?
It started on an elliptical trainer at a big Jewish conference, and the guy next to me, who was then the publisher of Moment magazine, said, you know, Sam, you've got a real connection with the clergy of and teachers of all these various denominations. Why don't you write something for them? So I laid out 70 chapters of what I would optimally write and set out at like 2,500 words a month. I started with a discipline to just get it done at that rate. And it took me 9 years to complete all 70 chapters, all these things that I wanted to discuss. And essentially, I'm trying to go into the kernel of Jewish life, of deeply living holidays, life cycle events, rituals, parenting, creativity, and mine all of those things for joy.
It's as you say, a joy of Judaism exploration. We will return here on Too Jewish and continue to explore that with Sam Glazer in just a moment. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, is celebrating services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, exactly 1 year ago, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community already that strives each day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday and Saturday, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located at 7315 North Oracle Road, just north of Ina on the west side of Oracle. Services, classes, and events are open to all. Join us Friday night at 7315 North Oracle Road. Shabbat evening services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. This Friday, join us for Tot Kabbalat Shabbat at 5:30 for young kids and their families. Join us for Shabbat, 7315 North Oracle Road. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend our Shabbat services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, Confirmation, High School program, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, and, of course, all of our services, go to www.BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA, Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish community in southern Arizona in its beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows, streaming them from the website, or downloading us at the Apple iTunes Store's very popular podcasts, Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the way that religions developed a sort of more corporate structure, hierarchy, more money involved at the top level, or when they developed in a very decentralized way, like Judaism did. One of the things that came to mind, of course, is sometimes difficult to get Jews to agree on whether it's sunny or not outside, let alone if they should have some centralized authority over their religious life. We argue, therefore, we are. You know, the Talmud is a 60-some volume collection of arguments. That's how we try to get at the truth, which means getting us to consensus isn't such an easy thing. Nonetheless, Judaism developed, obviously, without that centralized authority. And where there was a chief rabbi of a country, it was usually one that was appointed by the secular authorities or the religious authorities that weren't Jewish, so that they could have somebody to talk to and say that person represented Judaism.
Right, in the model of the exilarch that
we talked about, whether it's the chief rabbi of Britain or France or South Africa or somewhere. Other religions developed, sometimes highly centralized, but mostly also not with that kind of structure. Maybe let's talk about Islam.
Yeah, certainly, you know. The religions that we refer to as Eastern religions, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, don't have anything approaching the structure and the hierarchical nature of Roman Catholicism. And in fact, most other forms of Christianity, not all,
well,
but most.
I mean, yeah, the Orthodox churches have patriarchs, but it's not really like the Pope, and it doesn't have
The example of LDS with which we started, it has a hierarchy, but it's not nearly as elaborate or as strict as the Roman Catholic hierarchy. So, and we started really with two extreme examples, but I think one of the reasons that Judaism and Roman Catholicism are so different is that each felt a need over a period of centuries to differentiate itself from the other. And so, you know, one moved further in one direction, one moved further in the other, but that was partially a reaction to being so easily confused in the period that there were Jewish Christians and Christian Jews and all that. With Islam, much more democratic, much more independent, you certainly don't need any kind of clerical figure to pray. You have to pray five times a day, but you can pray in your office. You can unroll a prayer mat and pray.
And people do.
There are very few occasions for which you need a cleric in Islamic life. That's even more true of Buddhism and Hinduism. They're very individually oriented, and you know, there's some great thinkers and beautiful temples, but there's no religious structure to which all money is funneled. And if you think about it, I mean, the Islamic world is riven by lots of rivalries, primarily between Shia and Sunni, but then even within Sunni Islam, there are various sects like the Wahhabis, whatever. And to say that they don't get along perfectly well and they're not completely harmonious would be the understatement of the year. And it's a brand new year, but I can confidently predict that
there will be wars, religious wars within Islam in this 5780 year. I can guarantee that too.
Right. So, yeah, I think, you know, none of these other religions comes close to having the structure, the hierarchy, the concentration of wealth, or what may superficially look like a big business quality that the Roman Catholic Church does. Even the Orthodox Church, it has some of those aspects, but it's not...
not nearly as structured.
No, and also, I mean...
there are different national
churches.
There's
a patriarchate in Constantinople, right, but there's also...
a Russian Orthodox patriarch.
Exactly. So it's much more decentralized.
They talk about it, right, this whole thing.
Primus inter pares, first among equals.
First among equals, thank you. Very interesting excursion. Thanks for joining me on it, Tom. And we'll move on to other subjects next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivi Na'an Israel, the director of the Weintraub Israel Center in Baal Shtivi. Boker Tov.
Boker Or.
So there is an old slogan way back to, I don't know, the early days of Israel. They used to say, Yerushalayim Lomeid, Jerusalem studies, Haifa Oved, Haifa works, and Tel Aviv Roked, they dance, right?
Yeah.
Every city has its own characteristic and quality. That's true everywhere in the world, but Israel only has a few big cities really to speak of. They don't really say it like that anymore, do they?
No, they don't. Those three cities are very different from each other still.
Absolutely.
There's not so much changed in terms of the difference between them. Haifa is still a working city in a way.
Yeah.
Tel Aviv is the cultural basically.
Cultural,
artistic hub and
music,
all kinds of arts. And Jerusalem is still the main place for spiritual expression
for
and experience. But I have so many things to say about Jerusalem, about recent developments and how progressive and other groups are coming, are expressing themselves and the way they are, and about internal connections between people in Jerusalem, residents.
The interactions.
The interactions. There are several new places that have opened and are, in a way, form a meeting place for people of different affiliations within the Jewish world, but also outside.
But also outside, yeah.
You can talk about Machne Yehuda at night. You have different...
right, Machne Yehuda, of course, the big outdoor market in Jerusalem.
Yeah,
much more interesting than the Carmel market in Tel Aviv. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise.
Well, I'm Tel Avivian. I'm Tel Avivian. Let's put it. Make sure that we don't demean.
Don't want to demean Tel Aviv.
No, please don't decrease
Yehuda
its value.
But Machne Yehuda has now become a kind of center, a cultural center,
yes,
with music and food and
music
coffee
and food and
Jews,
you know,
Arabs,
and art
religious,
and people.
Secular.
And you when you go out at night, you can see all of these people going around the places. Sitting, eating, enjoying art, enjoying poetry, enjoying different experiences. But it's not only Machne Yehuda. There are some other places. Hansen House, which was a former hospital for a very bad disease that I don't remember how to say it in
Hansen's
English.
Hansen's disease, leprosy.
Yeah, Hansen disease, actually, yeah. Right.
It has now become a kind of cultural place?
Oh, yes. It's become a very interesting cultural place. I would recommend anyone to go there and see.
Wow.
They kept some of the Hansen disease treatment facilities, mm-hmm, as an historical...
But, of course, that disease is well under control.
Oh, yes. No, it's sterilized. No worries. If I was there, anyone can go there. It's it's not scary.
Right.
It's just that, you know, how
it's
to
just
deal
what it
with
used to be, the hospice for that, and now it's become...
It became a cultural center, and it's very, very nice and interesting. I suggest people look it up, Hansen House.
Well, that's fascinating. It's amazing how Israel changes. You know, I think that people they think about it as, you know, the ancient holy land, and then Tel Aviv is the modern part, and it's such a dynamic place.
It is dynamic. Haifa is more characterized with Arab and Jewish interaction and
cultural sharing and relationships. And
sharing the city and sharing the city resources and sharing their future. Tel Aviv is, as you said, much more playful, and Jerusalem is fascinating.
Fascinating. Thanks so much, Inval. We'll talk next week.
Thank you. Bye bye.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Leah has been married for just 2 months. She has her first big fight with her husband Arnold. Immediately afterwards, she goes to see the rabbi. "Hello, Leah. It's nice to see you again," says Rabbi Levy. "It seems like just yesterday I married you and Arnold under the chuppah. How are you doing?" "That's why I'm here, Rabbi," Leah replies, starting to cry. "Arnold and I just had an awful fight, just awful." "Don't cry," says the rabbi. "This often happens right after a marriage. Calm down. I think every marriage has to have its first fight sometime." "I know that, Rabbi," says Leah. "But what am I going to do with Arnold's body?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy. Delighted to have you. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
Anybody hungry? Let's talk about food.
Always. All the time.
You guys are skinny. You're Israelis. You're totally busy.
We try.
I'm sure you must be starving all the time.
No.
What's the difference between food here and in Israel for you?
Well, first of all, I haven't had schnitzel in like 3 months.
No schnitzel.
No schnitzel.
No schnitzel. This is like...
It's the worst.
Yeah, it's like no mac and cheese for like 3 months, and I just like, it's really hard.
Very difficult,
it's
I can
hard,
understand.
Yeah, it's hard to stay healthy here. I mean, where I live.
Without the schnitzel?
I mean, in Israel, like here, they're probably fried in like a thick layer of oil, and in Israel, it's like...
A little bit of olive oil. It's, you know.
Exactly.
We try
to keep it healthy, exactly.
Yeah. Just after a month, I ate my first schnitzel over here. I didn't know this much to the taste of the schnitzel, but just the shape of the schnitzel, and I saw the schnitzel, so I was like, oh, that's the best thing that I have ever had.
Schnitzel, for those who don't know, is basically pounded chicken or veal, breaded, fried. It was the standard Israeli dish, along with falafel. I lived on it one summer, 1976, long before you were born, and it was the only food I liked, actually, except for falafel and chocolate. So, Israeli food has gotten really diverse and different, and great. Used to be kind of bad. Danielle, you were saying, like, where you live in Israel, and you're in the Emek Yisrael, and you're in this beautiful rural area, there's how many fast food restaurants around you?
I noticed maybe two.
Two.
Like,
and how many are around you here in Tucson, Arizona?
Well, 2,000 maybe. It's really bad. And Israel, I feel like Israelis are like one of the most like healthy eating country, because we eat like pretty much always like homemade food, and we don't go out that much.
A lot
much.
Of fresh
like
vegetables, a lot of fresh fruits. Right.
Exactly. So it's like less eating outside. It's just like more easier. And here it's like the temptations are everywhere. It's like super hard. And I'm not used to it.
Right.
And I'm not in my own house. So it's like not the same. And you have to like adjust to like a new family and like how they eat and like...
More meat, I would expect.
Well, actually
meals.
Not. Ah. But like Americans have their like specific foods that they like. If it's like mac and cheese, which is the first time I've had it here in America. And...
Also not good for you, by the way.
Yeah, I'm sure not. Yeah, it's been... I'm going to the gym more often now because I have no choice.
You have to. And I know. It happens to every Israeli
have to keep my shape,
comes
yes.
here. They gain weight.
Absolutely.
What do you miss besides the fresh vegetables and fresh fruits?
Oh, my mom's cooking.
Your mom's cooking.
Sure.
What's her best dish?
Well, she actually cooks Thailandish food with like coconut milk and Ooh. Everything possible. So she's really the best at it. So I'm really missing that.
Did you have any good shakshuka here?
I made shakshuka at my family's house. I made shakshuka in a challah, and it turned out really good, actually.
Good. All right.
That's so like the only thing.
You didn't make it for me yet, I'm just saying.
Yeah, we can work on it. That's like the only thing.
The year is still pretty young, the Jewish year, but still.
Working on my skills, for sure.
All right, we're working. Anything you miss, Shai? Besides the schnitzel that you finally got.
Right. Yeah, I miss also the... You know, there's not... I cannot say that there is really Israeli food, because Israeli food is like... Syrian food and Iraqi food and Yemen food and all of that mixture. So yeah, that's just the veracity of food and the people. So also the people make the food. If I see like a Yemen eat jachnun in front of me, so it makes me feel like I want the jachnun or something. So all the atmosphere. But yeah, mostly jachnun in the mornings with the tomato, mashed tomato. Excellent.
I miss couscous.
We'll do the best we can, but you know, you might have to live with American food for another 10 months or something.
Yeah, all right.
All right. Thanks, guys. We will talk next week.
Thank
all right,
you.
Sure. Bye-bye.
And now a word of Torah. This coming week in Temple, we'll read the great portion of Noah, the most famous mariner in all history, a man who rode out the storm to end all storms in an ark. We know the great tale of Noah is shared to one degree or another by other ancient books of lore and legend, most notably the Sumerian epic of Gilgamesh, another guy who had to build a big boat to save humanity. You know, there's just something inherently comic about being stuck on a big ship with a large quantity of animals. It is also the ridiculous nature of trying to alert the world to imminent catastrophe, let alone the impossibility of trying to make a substantive difference in improving human behavior, especially while surrounded by animals. We are mostly familiar with the text of Noah itself. God sees wickedness and corruption have spread throughout the world. Human beings are acting in ways that should have been predictable to an all-knowing deity. Lying, cheating, stealing, committing adultery, asking foreign governments to intervene in elections, the usual. In response, God decides to destroy the world in a great flood, rain falling for 40 days and nights, the whole of humanity drowned in the deluge. One man is chosen to survive the flood because, the Torah tells us in this week's portion, he was righteous in his generation. Noah, Noach in Hebrew, is chosen to carry the banner of humanity to the next generation. Gathering his family about him and two of each animal, plus seven pairs of each kosher animal, so there's something to eat and something else to sacrifice to God if they make it, Noah builds the ark, loads the boat, goes not on a three-hour cruise, but one long enough to float away every trace of the depravity of humanity in those days. Eventually, Noah sends out first a raven and finally a dove to see if the world is dry enough to land on. The dove brings back a famous olive branch. They land and exit the ark. Life begins again. Noah, we're told, was a righteous man in his generation, which doesn't necessarily make him a righteous man in every generation, but it does set a reasonable standard that we ourselves might live up to. If we can't succeed in becoming fully righteous for all time, at least we can strive to be righteous in our own times, no matter how troubled they seem. You know, sometimes that very quest for righteousness can seem absurd or comical, but it remains our essential legacy. Like Noah, we all must try to perfect this challenging, often broken, even threatened world, whether we do it with an ark or in smaller, more practical ways, with mitzvot and acts of tzedakah. There was a very good but long-forgotten Broadway musical called 2x2 based on the Noah story and an earlier Clifford Odets play called The Flowering Peach. It starred the late Danny Kaye, and this song from that show is about what happens when you finally get off the ark. It's called When It Dries.
Why are you so gloomy? We're alive and we're afloat. After 40 days and nights, it's shipshape on the boat. Look, the sun's come out again and turned a rosy red. How can you be gloomy when you think of what's ahead. It's gonna be some terrific place when it dries, when it dries. You're gonna see wide and open space when it dries, when it dries. It's gonna be some terrific place. You're gonna see wide and open space. We're gonna have such a human race when it dries. The greenery's gonna have a shine when it dries, when it dries. The world'll be full and fat and fine when it dries, the greenery's gonna have a shine. The world'll be full and fat and fine.
The best thing of all, it's one third fine.
Half a million growing things will spring up from the ground.
Half a million bodies will be floating all around.
Room to work and grow and build a company of men.
Think about how much we can contaminate again.
There's gonna be air beyond compare when it dries,
when it dries.
With drinkable water everywhere
when it dries, when it dries. There's gonna be air beyond compare with drinkable water everywhere.
As long as you don't have people there when it dries.
When it dries,
when it dries.
When it dries,
when it dries.
When it dries.
Survive, we'll all live side by side in peace, caring for the animals and watching them increase.
Isn't it a miracle? A brand new world begins.
Think of all the fun we'll have
inventing brand new sins.
We're going to walk a righteous path when it dries. Remembering how he vents his wrath when it dries. We're going to walk a righteous path. Remembering how he vents his wrath.
That when he got mad, we took some bath.
When it dries.
The song When It Dries from the old musical 2x2 with music by one of the most successful Broadway composers, Richard Rodgers. He was Jewish, as was Clifford Odets and Danny Kaye, and, well, you get the idea. Our guest this morning, Sam Glazer, has a terrific book called The Joy of Judaism. It, well, you'll hear him talk about it in just a moment when we come back here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Political show that began last spring, the long-playing drama of Israel's prime ministership and the next government, if it ever forms, continues to turn and twist in the autumn winds. There was a new development this past week. For the first time in a decade, well, over a decade, somebody other than Bibi Netanyahu was asked to form a government in Israel. Yes, it was dramatic. Seventy-year-old Prime Minister Netanyahu has now called two elections this year, twice been given the chance by President Reuven Rivlin to put together a ruling coalition, and he has now failed twice. Finally, this past week, Rivlin turned to Netanyahu's centrist rival, Benny Gantz, leaving Netanyahu even more vulnerable in his fight for political survival. But although Netanyahu has failed to build a coalition government, Gantz, a former general and political novice, also has no clear path to doing so. After two inconclusive elections in April and September, there's no obvious means to form the divided Knesset into an actual majority in support of anyone. And so the drama continues to build. Okay, that's probably enough schmaltzy music for now. Shortly after the September 17th election also ended in stalemate, Rivlin gave Netanyahu 28 days to put together a governing coalition. During that period, which expired last Wednesday, Israel's longest-serving prime minister persuaded just 55 of the Knesset's 120 members, including his traditional far-right and ultra-Orthodox Jewish allies, to join his right-wing Likud party in a government. Having fallen six seats short of a ruling majority, that's a lot, Netanyahu returned his mandate to the president, and now Gantz gets his chance. One way out of the stalemate would be for the two largest parties, Likud and Gantz's new Kahol Lavan blue-white party, to form a national unity government. Talks centered on the possibility of a rotating premiership led nowhere. Gantz, a former armed forces chief, refused to join a government led by Netanyahu, citing the looming indictments against the prime minister in three corruption cases in which Netanyahu has denied wrongdoing. Gantz also said he wants a liberal government, probably shorthand for one that doesn't include Netanyahu's ultra-Orthodox religious partners. The last time anyone other than Netanyahu was asked to form a government in Israel was back in 2008, when Tzipi Livni of the now-defunct Kadima party was given that chance and failed. That led to an election in 2009, which was won by Netanyahu. Tzipi Livni never returned to frontline politics, a precedent not lost on Bibi Netanyahu. After receiving the formal nomination from Rivlin last week, Gantz now has 28 days to build a coalition, but as things stand now, he has the endorsement of only 54 lawmakers in Knesset, seven short of a parliamentary majority, and 10 of those 54 belong to the four-party Arab alliance. No party drawn from Israel's 21% Arab minority has ever been invited to join an Israeli government or has sought to serve in one. Without a deal with Netanyahu, Gantz could seek to form a minority government, Arab lawmakers backing him from the sidelines. That is a big political risk, however, in a country where Arab citizens' loyalty has been hotly debated and contested. Arab lawmakers would also surely face criticism, and perhaps worse, from their own community for propping up an Israeli government's policies towards what many Arabs regard as their fellow Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. If Gantz can't form a coalition in those 28 days, well, it's actually only 23 now, a three-week period would follow in which 61 Knesset members can ask the president to assign coalition building to any legislator, Netanyahu, Gantz, Avigdor Lieberman, somebody. If no such request is made in that time, the Knesset dissolves itself and another election is called. March 17th is a possible date, you know, just in time for Purim. That could give Netanyahu another chance at the ballot box, barring a Likud rebellion against him, unless, of course, he is in jail by then on the three corruption and one bribery case contemplated against him. Okay, a little more music then. Stay tuned on Too Jewish for yet another edition of As the Knesset Turns. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Sam Glazer is a Jewish musical star who has performed all over the world and many times, many places all over the world, a creative inspiration for many in the Jewish music world, and has written a book, The Joy of Judaism, really a labor of love, and also a practical book. Also, I should mention, Sam's an old friend. Welcome back.
Shalom, Sam.
So besides the fact that you have a terrific first name, the joy, why call it the joy of Judaism?
I feel like people look at Judaism as a big list of things they have to do. Burdensome mitzvot. You know, people come to a new holiday thinking, oi, we got to go through this again.
Right. Ol HaTorah, you know, the yoke of Torah that we have to schlep.
Yoke of Torah. Yeah, I actually discussed that in the book. Right. And that's a good example for how to get into the concept of joy in that you put a yoke on oxen to make them plow properly if you're in an agrarian society. So a yoke really is instrumental in creating abundance or bounty, shefa, as we say in Hebrew. And so when we're channeled in a Jewish way, living fully with the 613 mitzvot, living holidays very intensely, using the power of a Jewish community to bring out the best in each of the members, I think truly the net result, even though it is a lot of effort and it's expensive and et cetera, it results in joyful, connected people who are living with meaning and purpose. So I just think it's an ultimate lifestyle. And Sam, as you may know, I didn't grow up in this lifestyle.
Right. You pretty much grew up conservative, I would say.
Correct. Yeah. I was a Sinai Temple kid in Westwood. I did both NIFTY and USY events. I went through confirmation after getting out of Berklee College of Music and then Boulder, Colorado. My first music gig was singing in the octet for your dad.
Right. At Temple Emmanuel in Beverly Hills, that's right.
Exactly. So, you know, I really was already starting to see that there's more to life than just my conservative upbringing. I had the chance to learn in yeshiva several times, and my eyes were just open to the possibilities of Judaism. So I wanted, this book is just a desperate attempt to share with my generation, who I feel is sort of losing it, and then the next generation who's even more removed, since it really, you know, when you don't have parents who are nudging you into Jewish life, then it's very difficult to regain that focus.
You know, the Jewish world has changed a lot. I mean, we've seen it change kind of dramatically. I grew up in Pico Robertson. You talk about Pico Robertson in your book, which has become this hotbed of Orthodox expression. But when I was growing up, it was a mixed neighborhood. It certainly wasn't particularly Orthodox. Other parts of the Jewish world have become far more assimilated. You kind of play with that. There's a dynamic going on. What do you hope your book can do for people who maybe are debating whether to be connected Jewishly?
First of all, I make it clear that it's important that they affiliate communally wherever they're comfortable, wherever they have their chevra, their group, be it Reform, Conservative, or Orthodox, whatever synagogue, whatever rabbi. I have an entire chapter called Aselecha Rav, Finding a Rabbi to Call Your Own. And that's all really important. But perhaps what's more important is a personal relationship with God, a personal encounter with mitzvot and ritual. That we can't farm out our connection with God to clergy, and that doesn't work. So this book hopefully is looking at the macrocosm of what's available in Jewish life and hoping that people do further research into the microcosm as they get excited about any certain concept that connects with them.
You know, it's kind of an existential approach. You try the mitzvot, see the ones that are meaningful for you, have that experience. Does that mirror what you did, do you think?
Yeah, I think it does. I think there's so many ways in. There's 613 ways in. You know, there's 12 tribes amongst the Jewish people. There's so many different types of Jews, and this is the living Torah. Some of us serve with an intensive focus on social justice. Some of us serve by being really rigorous about putting on tefillin in the morning. Some of us serve by lighting Shabbat candles and then welcoming a dozen guests, some of whom have never tasted Shabbat, into their home for a Shabbat dinner. So there's lots of ways in.
You have a great section. I don't want to jump around too much, but I'm just gonna. Where you talk about marriage and then another section about raising Jewish kids. How careful were you in writing that not to make it too revealing of your own family experience? Because I always wonder about that.
Well, this book entirely revelatory of my family experience. In fact, at the end, in the last chapter, I just make it clear that if you've made it this far in the book, for my loyal readers, you are now part of my family. I really held very little back. The names were not changed to protect the innocent. And I did get my children's permission to share some intimate letters that I wrote to them and, you know, all the various adventures that we had. Because I really think it's through this one man's search that things become clear. And perhaps this is working for people. And I've been getting the most amazing comments. You know, the book came out over Shavuot. So it's only been a few months that it's been out on the market, and only now are people really using it. Or I walked into a sukkah, and they said, "Oh my God, Sam, we just read one of your chapters to everyone."
That's pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the best feeling. So I did go into tremendous detail about, in the parenting section, for example, of our own parenting experience. And it's not, you know, I only get 7 chapters to discuss parenting. It's not an exhaustive overview of how to be a Jewish parent, but it's just the things that work for me. And the one thing that I'll mention now is the thing that worked best for us was joining a Jewish community. Because right when our kids were born, we moved into this neighborhood, this shtetl, if you will, where the community really raises your child. And also, I really push the imperative of Jewish day school. Because afternoon school, religious school, is of extreme importance if there's nothing else. But something about a Jewish day school cements Judaism in a kid's life as something that's not an add-on.
Well, something normative, you know, it's part of your regular life.
Yeah, it's not something they got to suffer because their kids are out playing soccer, their friends are out playing soccer, back to their video games, and they have to go to Hebrew school, you know. No, this is their school. This is their life.
Sam, where can people go to find out more about you and find out more about the book?
If you put Joy of Judaism and Sam Glazer in an Amazon search engine, that's a very direct way to go there. SamGlazer.com is always a good place to hear music and see what's up with me. And then I just started a brand new website, which is called TheJoyOfJudaism.com.
All great places to go. Terrific book. Thank you so much for another great visit here on Too Jewish.
Sam, you're the best.
Thank you. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out, which might just be from Sam Glazer.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Cheryl Haff, author of a charming parody kids book, Goodnight Bubula. Our playout this morning comes from whom else? Sam Glazer, our guest this morning. It's his song, Shabbos. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Working so hard, I keep on wondering if there is a chance I will ever be through. I'm coming so far, but just as I'm finishing, it seems there is always some more work to do. I need a day to collect my thoughts, to spend some time with you. Here comes Shabbos, Shabbos, Shabbos,
Shabbos, Shabbos,
Shabbos, Shabbos, Shabbos, Shabbos, Shabbos, Shabbos, Shabbos, Shabbos, Shabbos, Shabbos,
Shabbos, Shabbos,
Shabbos, Shabbos, Shabbos,
Shabbos, Shabbos, Shabbos.
Go Friday Eve, the beggar and the billionaire will each have a feast that will last through the night. Who could believe that family everywhere are singing the songs by the same candlelight. They're taking the time to appreciate the wonderful things that you do. Here comes Shabbos, Shabbos, Shabbos,
Shabbos,
Shabbos, Shabbos, Shabbos.
Good Shabbos
to you. Shabbos, Shabbos, Shabbos,
Shabbos,
Shabbos, Shabbos, Shabbos.
Sponsored by 2 Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.